Welcome to the Heritage Radio Network. It's a part two of a Heritage Radio Network special three-part series called Out to Pasture, Meeting the Demand for Local Meat in New York City and Beyond. I'm your host, Nelson Harvey. In this series, we're examining what it's actually going to take for farmers, slaughterhouse workers, butchers, and others to meet the growing demand for good, clean, local meat in New York City. And who knows, maybe we'll uncover some lessons about how to do it nationally. Last week, we looked at farm issues, and we'll conclude next week by taking a hard look at butcher shops and the important role that they play in the local meat economy. But today, in episode two, we enter the strange and mysterious world of the slaughterhouse. Why is there a shortage of slaughterhouses in New York State? What's wrong with the ones we do have? And what is it like to slaughter and butcher animals for a living? We're about to find out. Okay. So if you've walked down Mulberry Street on the Lower East Side of Manhattan recently, you know that it's mostly populated with hip little clothing boutiques, touristy Italian marinara shops, maybe a few bodegas. And while it's no surprise that the street has changed a lot over the past couple of centuries, you might be surprised at exactly what used to be there. See, there's this well-known butcher named Thomas DeVoe, who lived on the corner of Spring and Mulberry Streets in 1822. He was a big writer. He once wrote a book that listed every single item on sale in the public markets of New York City. But in one of his writings, he noted that there were between 25 and 30 slaughterhouses within 200 yards of his home, which, when the wind was blowing, would, quote, acquaint you of their close proximity. That was just his 1822 way of saying that the slaughterhouses smelled terrible, and that is why, in the mid-1800s, Mulberry Street became known as Slaughterhouse Street. Now, it seems unbelievable to think of so many animals being slaughtered in a neighborhood where today you can drop $500 on a pair of shoes. But for most of New York's history, that was how things were done. Live animals were shipped or driven into New York and dispatched in a network of small slaughterhouses, at first in Lower Manhattan and then extending north and into Brooklyn. And it was an arrangement that came mainly out of the fact that until the late 1800s, you couldn't really refrigerate meat. So before you killed an animal, you had to get it to the place where you planned to eat it. But this had a side effect, and one that seems strange when you think of the massive, mysterious plants where most of our meat is killed today. Until the 1880s, your typical New Yorker wouldn't eat a side of beef if the cow hadn't been slaughtered in their neighborhood, or at least in their borough. And oddly enough, New Yorkers back then had a distrust of meat from far away that many of the yuppie locavores living in Soho today probably share. Yet even if New Yorkers back then liked local meat, it didn't mean that they liked the slaughterhouses where it was processed, and in fact, they detested them. If I had to sum up the entire history of slaughterhouses in New York in four words, they would be these. Not in my backyard. Until 1789, it was illegal to even slaughter or sell meat outside of a publicly sanctioned slaughterhouse or market, and there weren't nearly enough of these to process the amount of meat that New Yorkers wanted. After private slaughter was legalized, the small slaughterhouses that spread throughout the boroughs became a nuisance and a public health threat to the city's growing population. Sanitation, of course, was poor in these slaughtering shacks, and many New Yorkers found the smell and sights of slaughter, blood, bones, animal hides, pretty sickening. In the mid-1800s, to accommodate the growing city, slaughterhouses were pushed north of 40th Street to a few blocks around the Hudson and East Rivers, and this trend would continue. In general, it seemed that the more people needed slaughterhouses, the more they wished they'd just go away. Eventually, they did go away, or at least most of them did, and it was an ancestor of mine, a guy named Gustavus Swift, who helped to speed their departure from New York and to cure New Yorkers of their fear of non-local meat. Swift started slaughtering animals in Chicago, and the refrigerated meat that he shipped to New York starting in about 1880 was so cheap that consumers couldn't stay away, even though they worried about its safety. Swift's prices were so low, in part because he saved a lot of money by shipping dead animals to the East rather than live animals, which are much heavier, but he also took full advantage of something that small New York slaughterhouses really couldn't, and that is economies of scale. Compared to the slaughtering shacks of the East, Swift's Chicago slaughterhouses were massive industrial machines. They employed hundreds of men, each of whom was often given just a single task, a single cut to make over and over again as animals came rolling down the production lines. This might sound slightly familiar, and in fact, it was after visiting Swift's factories and seeing his disassembly lines that Henry Ford came up with his idea for the automobile assembly line. By fragmenting and dividing the labor of slaughtering, Swift increased productivity without adding too much to costs, and his scale allowed him to be extremely creative with something called rendering, the rather unsavory practice of making the scrap parts of an animal into everything from cosmetics to cooking oil. I should note, by the way, that for a while the unofficial Swift and Company motto was this: we use everything but the squeal. Nice, huh? But by doing this, Swift gained access to a source of revenue that smaller slaughterhouses in places like New York didn't have. And he was able to push a lot of those smaller slaughterhouses out of business. When Swift died in 1903, just six companies controlled over 90% of the nation's beef slaughter. So we've got industrialization, we've got consolidation, and since Swift's death, these trends have only accelerated in the meat industry. It's a business in which it often pays to be big. And here's a case in point. Swift itself is now owned by a giant South American company called JBS SA. In September of 2009, that company agreed to buy the giant chicken processor Pilgrim's Pride, which you may have heard of. And if the deal goes through, then just four companies will control the vast majority of U.S. meat slaughter. And smaller plants continue to disappear. A recent article on the food website Chow.com noted that according to the Federal Food Safety and Inspection Service, the number of federally certified slaughterhouses fell by about 200 between 2001 and 2005. Having federally inspected plants, of course, is critical because if your meat doesn't go through them, you can't sell it retail. And of the plants that closed during that period, very small plants with 10 or fewer employees represented about half of them. So how does this all affect New York City's local meat industry? Well, the wave of consolidation over the past 100 years or so has left the local slaughterhouse infrastructure of the Northeast in tatters. There are about 40 slaughterhouses in New York in 2008, USDA slaughterhouses, that is, but many of these only do chickens, and many more won't slaughter animals for anyone other than the plant owner themselves. So the real number is probably closer to 25 or 30, and that means that the wait times for a farmer to get a kill slot in a slaughterhouse in New York can be as long as 6 months. Judy LaBelle of the Glenwood Center, who we spoke with last week, told me the story of one farmer who had his truck break down the day he was supposed to take his animals to slaughter. His truck broke down in June, and he couldn't get another appointment until January. So the outlook is grim. Clearly, we need some insight from some people who are working to solve this problem. And after a short break, we're going to hear from Kathleen Harris, a livestock farmer up in Sprakers, New York, who was almost driven out of business when a slaughterhouse near her closed. Then later, we'll talk to meat maestro Lowell Carson about what it's like to run a slaughterhouse for a living. What fun. This is the Heritage Radio Network.
Listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
And we're back. A quick note, this show, along with tons of others, is available online at heritageradionetwork.com or as a podcast through iTunes on your computer. Now back to slaughterhouses. Our first guest, Kathleen Harris, is a farmer who raises pigs and lambs at Currytown Farm near Sprakers, New York. And she's the marketing and processing coordinator for something called the Northeast Livestock Processing Service Company, which we'll talk about. Kathleen Harris, welcome to the Heritage Radio Network.
Thank you for having me on today.
Yeah, I appreciate you being with us. Now, if I understand your story correctly, you had to get out of farming and find other work for a while after the USDA slaughterhouse that you were using lost its certification. Do I have that story right? And can you tell us that story?
Yes, that is correct. And it was a sad day for us on the farm, that's for sure. What happened was we had been watching the slaughterhouse situation go from bad to worse over the 20 years we had been using them. And this slaughterhouse that we were dealing with called us up one day and said, come get your meat out because we lost our grant of inspection, USDA inspection.
Wow.
And so all the meat that we had there, which was several animals worth of meat, if it was already cut and wrapped and frozen, we could take it out because it was all done under USDA. But we had several 100 pounds of pork bellies and hams and other products in the brine or in the smokehouse that had not yet been finished. And they said, oh, and by the way, you have to eat that because now you can't sell it because it wasn't done under USDA.
So you lost all that meat that you had with
it. Yeah. And it was a hard situation for us because, you know, we knew it had gone from bad to worse, and we used that as an opportunity to look one last time for another slaughterhouse, and we found that the next one, closest one, just to get the pigs to them and then to get them into the city, it was going to be cost prohibitive. So we decided to get out at that time of using the slaughterhouses, and we made a decision to leave the retail marketplace entirely and only sell animals live from the farm. And so we lost 75% of our income in that one split second decision.
Wow, that's incredible. Kind of a good parable, I guess, for the broader problem. And since that happened, you've transitioned a bit and made it your profession, basically, to help small farmers overcome the hurdles to getting their animals processed. You and a few others have started the Northeast Livestock Processing Service Company. Can you talk about why you think a company like that is necessary and what exactly you do for small farmers?
Well, first, I'd like to say that I did not start it. It was the RC&D of the Hudson Valley, the Resource Conservation and Development Group of the Hudson Valley, and their membership that developed the company. And then when it came to hiring someone to execute the business model, I was hired to do that. And just having gone through everything we had gone through with regard to slaughterhouses, it certainly gave me the passion to go forward to try and solve this problem for others. But in the meantime, I had gotten work off the farm, and it wasn't even related to my field, so I was very anxious to take on something that was my background and in my field.
Related to farming.
Yeah.
And what are the sorts of things that that the company tries to coordinate to help farmers get their animals processed?
Well, we first of all talk to the farmers and find out where they're located and what kind of services they require. Then we try to match them up with the best fit processor for them, given those parameters and also their expectations of price and quality of work and things like that. Once we make a fit between the farmer and the processor, then we schedule for them and we take and convey their cutting instructions to the processor, because oftentimes farmers, especially those who are new to working with butchers, don't understand the language of the butcher, and so we can make that transition for them very easy and painless.
Sure. Now, if there's a shortage of small sort of custom slaughterhouses, why are farmers so hesitant to process their meat through some of the larger industrial slaughterhouses? Maybe, you know, using yourself as an example, what is it about the larger slaughterhouses that you're uncomfortable with?
Well, first of all, there aren't a lot of large industrial slaughterhouses around here. There's a couple larger plants in Pennsylvania, but everything that the farmers have access to here for custom processing would be categorized as a small or very small plant under USDA standards. But the incidence of foodborne illness and the intensity of inspection is, you're weighing in with much better odds at the small slaughterhouses. The incidence of foodborne illness, I have never seen any outbreak or recalls or anything like that from a small slaughterhouse. In fact, they don't even let the meat go out that's been tested until they get a negative test back. So they don't have a recall policy because they don't need one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The other thing is that the intensity of inspection is so great at these small slaughterhouses. You have one inspector reviewing an animal live as it stands in the holding pen prior to slaughter, and then reviewing it again through the process, and then reviewing it again post-mortem. So there is a lot of intensity of inspection when you only have a few animals to look at all day long versus thousands.
Sure, sure. And in terms of opening up a small slaughterhouse, I wonder, what are the barriers to doing that people are finding so difficult to overcome? And do you think that there might be a role for a mobile slaughterhouse sort of in the meantime?
Well, first of all, it's a lot like farming. It's very capital intensive, the structure and the building. You know, farmers and slaughterers and processors aren't getting rich, that's for sure. We do have much higher costs of production and operational costs and taxation here in this area. But also, USDA is designed basically to be one size fits all. So although they made a program a few years ago that would make them a little bit more agreeable and less punitive with the small and very small plants, they still have a job to do, and that's to ensure food safety for the American public. So they have not really backed down their standards any with regard to these small plants, even though they're a much safer risk. So it's very hard for the small slaughterhouse to compete. They don't have one person on staff that can just dedicate to being the HACCP manager and, you know, going around and working with the inspector to appease them and all that they need, nor do they have an on-site laboratory for the samples. And so there are so many other things that they're just not scale appropriate, and they're not cost effective at their level.
Sure, sure. And what's your feeling on mobile slaughterhouses? You know, slaughterhouse basically in a tractor trailer that would drive around and go to farms as a sort of a stopgap measure to take care of small farmers before we've got some of these permanent plants.
Well, I think that's a very good idea. Of course, our farmers are very concerned about humane treatment of animals, so less travel for the animal prior to slaughter is a very important consideration. It's less disturbing for the animal, and everybody's better off at that. The mobile units are normally less expensive and more flexible.
Kathleen, apologize. I'm going to have to cut you off there. Thank you very much for being with us. We're a little short on time here. Kathleen Harris, farmer from Sprakers, New York, and coordinator of the Northeast Livestock Processing Service Company. Thanks again.
You're welcome.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. After a break, we're back with our second guest, Lowell Carson, the owner of Nichols Meat Processing just west of Albany, New York, to talk about what it's like to actually run a slaughterhouse. Stay with us.
By the lane with my hands in my pocket, jingling a wish coin that I stole from finding out what's done on the cares in the world. When I get older, climbing up on the back porch fence just to see the dogs running with the ring and a question and my shivering voices singing through a crack.
Na, 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 na. I better go it alone. Na, 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 na.
Down on the corner, see me standing on a makeshift comb with the dust. Black shadow, pulled a hammer from a coal mine down when your daddy was smoking. Combed my hair back, stuck a match on the bathroom wall where my number is written. Driving on the sidewalk, looking back at the The sky is burning in my rear view.
Na, 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 na.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
And we're back with Lowell Carson, owner of Nichols Meat Processing, a slaughterhouse in Altamont, New York. Carson's been in just about every aspect of the meat business, from restaurants to butcher shops to door-to-door meat sales, but today he's here to tell us about slaughterhouses. Lowell Carson, welcome to the Heritage Radio Network.
Yes, hello there. Thank you.
Thanks very much for being with us. Now, we're actually reaching you at the slaughterhouse, Lowell, is that right?
Yes, I'm here now.
And you've been cutting meat all day? You've been working all day?
Just set down my knife, or just got done cutting for today, for the week.
And this is a really busy time of year for you, isn't it?
Yeah, fall's the busiest time of the year for us right now. It's really just when everyone's harvesting their animals.
Sure. And I have to ask you before we go any further. Have you still got your chainmail on? Have you still got your chainmail apron?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Tell us about that, because that's a pretty unusual bit of your wardrobe, as I understand it. Why do you wear that?
It's a metal apron. It's about 3.5 pounds, and you never know when you need something for safety until something happens. And it's just like everything. You think you have everything. We wear mesh gloves and that. And last year I had a little accident. Stabbed myself in my thigh. It was real close to my vein, which is really dangerous.
Sure. And,
wow. That's when we decided to get the aprons. I have two sons, and they each get one too as well. We for protection reasons why.
Sure.
They actually use it too for shark protection, the same type of material and metal and everything like
wow.
that.
Wow. And your two sons, you mentioned that they work with you. I came up to visit you last April, came up to the slaughterhouse, and when I was up there, you said that your two sons were probably some of the only people left around who knew how to break down a whole steer. Obviously, not everybody wants to work in a slaughterhouse. Why do you think people hesitate to enter a trade like yours?
I don't think it's just hesitate to enter. It's just there's a lack of them around to gain any experience the way it is anymore.
Hard to get training.
Yeah, to get trained people these days in the supermarkets are mostly they open the boxes up and the packages are already done, weighed, and cut. And no one has the skill actually to go out and get it anymore. That's what it's a problem around.
And you teach butchering, don't you, at SUNY Cobleskill?
I used to. I did for 3.5 years there. It was a 2-year course. They did hands-on training. Which was really good because that's what you need is to develop a skill. It is a skill, and it takes a lot of practice and repetition to do it.
You mentioned that you weren't so into the whole PowerPoint presentation aspect of it. You're more into the hands-on skill of it.
Yeah, that's what happened. They changed it. The school was driving to a 4-year degree where they wanted more PowerPoint presentations, less hands-on. They wanted me to demonstrate more than teach a skill, and that's I was there to teach a skill, and takes time and a lot of hours, and things changed.
Yeah. I want to shift gears a little bit. Yours is a USDA-certified slaughterhouse, and as a small plant, I know you've had some difficulty following USDA regulations. Can you talk about that a little bit? What's been difficult and why?
Well, it started years ago with HACCP. Actually, it's a plan the USDA government came up during the Clinton administration, and it ended up taking 1/3 of the slaughterhouses out of business in New York State. That regulation alone. What happens is the USDA has people like in Texas A&M and all these doctors and professors that write these rules and regulations, and they're really hard to figure them out. So what a small plant has to do, like myself, to understand these regulations, we have to hire outside people, the doctors too, that understand this and have to write the HACCP plan for us. And it costs really a lot of money. It's a few thousand dollars to have this plan done to start with. And then once you get it established and you start using it, the USDA changes regulations quite a bit as the industry changes, and that costs us money each and every time that event happens. And it becomes very, very costly.
Sure. It sounds like it's a pretty big chunk out of an already low-margin business for you.
Yes, yes, it is. And too, again, it's these regulations are written by doctors and all these universities, and it's hard for the small person to understand these, which, you know, you have to hire outside help to understand this stuff.
And what do you think is the remedy to that problem? I mean, does New York need to adopt its own set of slaughterhouse standards independent of the USDA, or what do you think would remedy that?
Well, I think New York State needs to step in and realize what's going on. The state of Vermont has already, and realize that the small plants like myself are going out of business because of the regulations and the changing of the regulations. And then there's testing on top of it. I have only owned this business now 4 months, and I've already got over $1,100 worth of testing of just samples, beef samples, ground samples, and it's a very a lot of money for a small plant to encounter.
Sure.
And on top of that, if I wanted to work overtime, there's a lot of plants in the area that have 75 employees or more that's in my circuit. And they have the same regulations I do as me with four people working here. Like if I worked overtime, it's $54 an hour, and that takes a lot of money out of me to cover that with four people to do that. Versus a company that has 75 employees or more, they have the same costs as I got with the USDA.
So it's almost like the regulations are incentivizing you to grow, to be a bigger plant rather than to be a small custom plant.
Yes, very, very much. They for the small independents, they're trying to snuff us out with these costs. The costs are going up. Every 6 months, I generate a new type of testing I got to do, which adds to the cost and my time. During the day, I have over an hour and a half of paperwork I have to do for the USDA. I'm only allowed 7 hours of working time, and I have to do the paperwork in that 7 hours of time.
Wow.
Yeah, and unless you're a large company that have secretaries and other people to cover that, it really takes a lot out of you.
Sure, sure. One of the things that I wondered about when I came up to see you, and again talking to you on the phone in the fall when it's busy, you've obviously seen a lot of pretty huge seasonal variations in your business, and many slaughterhouses do, since most farmers bring their animals in for processing in the fall. How do you make a business work with that kind of variation? How do you compensate for that in other seasons?
Well, right now, my main thing is to change the farmers' train of thinking on when to harvest their animals, to spread it out during the year. What's helped me now, that's starting to make it a year-round business, that the farmers' markets have tripled up here, and they're making them year-round, which is really helping out a lot, spreading the farmers' harvesting time out. We got indoor markets now in the winter we never had, and now the farmers can sell their products in the winter, so now they can actually take their animals and harvest them at a different time of year, because they can sell them year-round instead in the fall, when the people have outdoor markets. And this has helped my business in the last 2 years quite a bit, to spread it out, to try to relieve this fall influx that we have right now, what I'm going through.
Interesting. So you're seeing an increase in demand kind of year-round. That's interesting.
Yeah, because the farmers markets have been growing in leaps and bounds. And again, they're more year-round than they are seasonal. And it's changing the harvesting time, so they spread it out, and it's really relieving it off the slaughterhouses.
Sure. Well, Lowell Carson of Nichols Meat Processing in Altamont, New York, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. It's been interesting.
Yeah, I just want to make a mention there. It used to be Nichols Meat Market.
Oh, I was going to ask about that.
I just purchased it from Mr. Nichols 4 months ago.
Sure.
And it, It is. It's called. It's Double L Ranch Incorporated in Altamont, New York, and it's our name now. And
good stuff, Lilac. Yeah, congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. We're looking to grow and prosper and help out the communities even more than what we have in the past.
You bet. All right. Thanks, Lowell. Have a good afternoon.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
You've been listening to the second installment of the series we're calling Out to Pasture, Meeting the Demand for Local Meat in New York City and Beyond. And sadly, our slaughterhouse tour is nearing its end. At this point, a few things are clear. Just like it was in New York 200 years ago, slaughtering remains the industry that no one wants to see. But while we weren't looking, we missed some important developments. Massive consolidation, the fraying of small local livestock infrastructure, and now there aren't enough slaughterhouses to process the kind of meat that more and more people want to eat, meat that's been responsibly locally raised on a relatively small scale. On the bright side, we've learned about some of the potential solutions, new regulations for smaller plants, organizations to coordinate slaughter for many of the area farmers, and even mobile slaughterhouses to tide us over until more permanent ones are built. But let me tell you something. If you thought this was interesting, tune in next week for the final installment of our series. Next week, butcher shops. Learn about the history of butchers in New York City and why they play a crucial role in the local meat economy. And you might think butchers are sexy now, but did you know they used to wear top hats? If that grabs you, then you better listen in next week. This show and many others are available online at heritageradionetwork.com or as a podcast. Just search iTunes for that. Thanks to Lorenzo Ragioneri and Nat Wiener, the Heritage producer and engineer, respectively, for helping to shepherd, shepherd this meat series through to completion. I'm your host, Nelson Harvey, and until next week, this is the Heritage Radio Network.